Today at Reader's Corner, an encore conversation with Robert Kanacki, author of The Fifth Domain, defending our country, our companies, and ourselves in the age of cyber threats. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. There is much to fear in the dark corners of cyberspace, from well-covered stories like the Stuxnet attack, which helped slow Iran's nuclear program, to lesser-known tales like Eternal Blue, the 2017 cyber battle that closed hospitals in Britain and froze shipping crates in Germany in midair. We have entered an age in which online threats carry real-world consequences. In his new book, The Fifth Domain, Robert K. Kanacki, with co-writer Richard A. Clark, offers an urgent new warning and a gripping inside look at how governments, firms, and ordinary citizens can confront and contain the tyrants, hackers, and criminals bent on turning the digital realm into a war zone. Robert K. Kanacki is a senior fellow for cyber policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. His work focuses on internet governance, public-private partnerships, and cyber conflict. Mr. Kanacki served from 2011 to 2015 as director for cybersecurity policy at the National Security Council. He is the co-author, again with Richard A. Clark, of the New York Times bestseller Cyber War. Robert Kanacki, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Good to be here.
Well, maybe you could begin by helping us with who was on the offense when it comes to Stuxnet and Eternal Blue.
So Stuxnet was a capability that was targeted at Iran's nuclear centrifuge program, their program for developing their own nuclear fissile material. It was a very sophisticated program that, according to press reports, was allegedly carried out by the U.S. government and the Israeli government in combination in order to slow down that country's nuclear development capability. And what it did was, at the time, incredibly sophisticated. The Iranians had protected their nuclear development program by essentially taking it offline. They didn't have any computers connected to the internet that were working on their system. So they had what we call an air gap. Essentially, there was, in their thinking, no way that any threat from the public internet was going to get onto their system and be able to disrupt it. But what this system did, what Stuxnet did, is it found a way onto the system, probably through a thumb drive that was used to transfer material, and then it operated autonomously. It had nobody in control of it, and it was able to disrupt and slow down their program for several years.
And Eternal Blue, as I remember it, was not exactly a product of the good guys.
So Eternal Blue is, again, I'll use the term allegedly a couple times. A lot of this is just based on press reporting and hasn't been confirmed or denied by the U.S. government. But Eternal Blue was a capability that was allegedly stolen from the U.S. government and then used by the Russians in a series of cyber attacks, probably because it was very capable malware, but also because using it would implicate the U.S. or at least embarrass the United States government.
Let's talk about one other one. If you could tell us about NotPetya, that was a real shocker as far as I'm concerned anyway.
So NotPetya is, I think, one of the scarier stories and the more interesting stories of the last couple of years. In the NotPetya attack, what the Russians did was they compromised a company in Ukraine that was the equivalent of, say, QuickBooks here. It was accounting software used by almost every company in Ukraine. And they compromised that company's server, and they used that server to get their malware, what was dubbed NotPetya, into all these companies. And once it was inside these companies, it looked and it operated like ransomware, right? The kind of malware that criminals use to extort money from companies by encrypting all the systems and saying, okay, pay us Bitcoin into this Bitcoin wallet, and we'll give you the code to unlock your systems. That's what it looked like initially. But if you tried to pay, there was actually no way to do that. And the perpetrators on the other end of it weren't actually interested in recovering any money. They didn't even have any capability to get you your data back. So it was really simply a destructive attack that was designed definitely to hurt and punish Ukrainian companies and possibly to intentionally harm Western companies that were operating inside of Ukraine. companies like Maersk and Merck and Mondelez are the big three that have been in the press. These companies had operations in Ukraine, and they were therefore vulnerable to this malware getting in their system. And it wreaked absolute havoc and caused, by some estimates, $10 billion or more dollars in damage.
What is it about Ukraine that causes these companies to go there?
Well, I mean, it's the capability that their science and technology programs have. They produce very, very good coders, very good computer scientists, and they work at, you know, a fraction of what a computer scientist or a coder might cost in the United States. And so, I mean, well beyond those three companies have research and development centers in Ukraine. Microsoft, Cisco, Oracle, you name it, all the big U.S. tech companies have presences there.
You know, by the time I finished reading your book, one of the questions that did occur to me, and you say in the acknowledgments at the end of your book that the cyber workforce is stretched thin. And I wondered, are our universities and colleges doing enough to produce the cyber specialists we need on the front lines, either for corporations, governments, or whatever?
So I would say that our universities are working overtime to develop programs and to attract students into those programs. But it can be fairly challenging to draw enough students into those programs. A lot of students at 18 don't show that much interest in the field. Computer science similarly has that problem. And so to the degree to which you're drawing on the same pool and the same skill sets, you're really in a hard place trying to compete for students to get them interested in these programs. I think one of the things that we've been advocating, well, I'll give you a couple things we've been advocating. The first is that we would be much better off if computer science programs were incorporating cybersecurity so that we weren't bolting on cybersecurity after the fact, that cybersecurity was something that if you're learning to develop software, you're learning how to do it securely, or if you're learning network engineering, you're learning how to do that securely. That's one of the strong things we push for. But the other thing is to create on-ramps into the field for people coming out of the military, people who are looking to transition careers, people who have always had an interest but haven't had any technical training or education. That's probably one of the best ways that we can get the workforce that we need.
So there's offense and there's defense in this business of cyber warfare. And I believe you, at one point in the book, make the argument that we can do a very good job as far as defense is concerned. And that's really important, given how scary some of the cyber attacks coming from the offense are. Could you help us understand that? Where is the defense going?
Yeah, I mean, so I'll tell you the sort of good news story that we put into the Fifth Domain was when Dick and I wrote Cyber War, which was our first book together on the subject, published in 2010, written in 2009. The state of the field was overwhelmingly that offense had a tremendous advantage in cyberspace, right? That the general view then was attackers could choose who they wanted to hit, when they wanted to hit them, what they wanted to hit them with, that they only had to be right one time. That is, they only had to get into one system, compromise one system, and then they could blow a whole network open. And then on the other side of it, defenders had to be everywhere, and they had to be defending everything all the time. That was the conventional wisdom a decade ago. I think at least at the cutting edge of cybersecurity today, that kind of thinking has totally been flipped on its head. And companies are recognizing that, you know, wait a second, you're talking about my network that I own, that I operate, that I can know inside and out. That should give me an advantage. The attackers don't actually just want to get into one system. They want to get into your computers and they want to lock them up with ransomware, or they want to take data off your systems and sell it on the black market, or give it, if they're, say, the Chinese, to a Chinese national champion company. But they want to do a lot more than just compromise a single system. And so the thinking that's involved in the last decade is to say, look, all we have to do is disrupt the adversary at any one point along the path that they need to go down to accomplish their mission. If we can do that, we can detect them and stop them, we win. They've got to avoid detection and avoid us containing and remediating their activity. throughout this entire chain of events. And so from that perspective, there's been a big shift in thinking about whether the offense truly has an advantage. The last thing I'll say on this is one of the more surprising interviews we did in the book is we talked to a guy named Dave Itell, who is a former NSA hacker, a member of TAO, what was called Tailored Access Operations, the really cream of the crop in offensive cyber operations. I mean, think of these guys as, you know, SEAL Team 6 in cyberspace. And he was one of those guys, you know, recruited right out of high school and went straight in. And now he's on the outside, and he develops offensive cyber operations as a contractor for the U.S. military. And when we asked him, he said, you know, he didn't even think that there was any offensive advantage anymore. He thought the defense had the advantage because of advances in artificial intelligence for detecting malware, for finding what are called zero-day exploits, that that his job was actually harder than being a defender's job today. And that really surprised us.
Well, there was one chapter in your book which shows that at least just a few years ago, the offense was in pretty good shape and the defense hasn't quite figured things out yet. And I'm talking about the chapter entitled Democracy Shield, which I think is a must-read for any American who cares about where this country's going, and especially in light of what's happening these days as far as the Ukraine is concerned. I want you to start this story by telling us about Adrian Chen and what he discovered in regard to the Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg in 2015.
So the Internet Research Agency, known in the field as IRA, is essentially a state-sponsored, Russian state-sponsored group of essentially Internet trolls, right? These are people who work all day long creating fake accounts on Facebook, on LinkedIn, creating Twitter accounts, placing advertising meant to sway elections, setting up dummy companies so they can do that. And so what the IRA did, what the Internet Research Agency did, was in the election, they created these fake personas, and then they went and they would engage with voters, and they were very highly targeted. And they said, okay, we know that we want to try and shift voters with this certain demographic in this county. And we're going to do that by a variety of ways. We're going to try and encourage certain people to go vote for certain candidates, encourage other people not to vote at all. And we're going to do that by essentially posing as people who could be their neighbors. That, I think, is a fascinating story. The even more fascinating story that is, I think, still coming to light today is that this isn't something that the Russians or the IRA has been doing only in 2016, and it's not something that they're just gearing up now for 2020. This is activity that they're engaged in on a continual basis with the goal of disrupting our society and creating resentments and trying to sow discord. And so they've been involved in everything from election interference to spreading anti-vaccination sentiment, and even have done things like trying to encourage the state of California to split off from the United States, separation movements in the United States. And so it really shouldn't be thought of just as election interference. It's really an effort to be disruptive to the United States.
By the way, we had Michael McFaul here a few weeks ago, and he talked in his book, Cold War to Hot Peace, about a computational project at Oxford University's Internet Institute that found Russian activities on social media platforms were heaviest 6 months after the 2016 election. I think many Americans figure that was kind of a one-off. We don't hear a lot about what's going on now. Maybe you could enlighten us a little bit. As you said in your last answer, this is ongoing. It's not like it's over.
No, I mean, it's certainly not, right? I think really the way to frame this is almost not so much from a cybersecurity perspective, but from a geopolitical perspective to understand Russia's place in the world now and Vladimir Putin and what motivates him and his inner circle. And the best way to understand it is to say that Russia is in many ways a state in decline. It's a country that relies on exporting raw materials. It's a country with a population that is shrinking. with incredibly poor quality of life. I think one of the scariest facts about Russia that really enters into our thinking on deterring Russia is the fact that as high as 25% of the Russian population doesn't have indoor plumbing. Right, that's a huge percentage of Russians who aren't really living in a first world country. And so from that perspective, understanding what Russia is doing online really understands that their thinking is about how do they bring down their adversaries? How do they diminish the capabilities of our Western European allies? How do they sow discord and discontent internally within the United States? How do they try and separate U.S. and our European allies? And so that's what this activity is really aimed at. The elections are, I think, the high points in some ways of the activity, but you got to view it as an overall campaign.
Are there other countries besides Russia? China comes to mind that rank up there with Russia in terms of what they're doing in cyberspace?
Well, so it's I think right now, one of the things that we've talked about is that in many ways, China was viewed as the bad actor during the Obama administration, right? There was a heavy focus on stopping China from stealing intellectual property because that's what the Chinese have been doing for almost 20 years, right? Their focus has been to say, we're going to go steal the plans for U.S. weapon systems. We're going to go steal the code from U.S. software companies. We're going to give that to our national champion companies like Huawei. It's in the news a lot lately. That's what the Chinese have predominantly been focused on, right? How do they lift their economy up? The Russians, on the other hand, prior to, I would say, 2014, 2015, were very much focused on traditional diplomacy, traditional diplomatic intelligence, figuring out what the United States was doing, targeting the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the White House, the State Department. What they weren't doing as much at that point was interfering. So that was a shift. Right now, what we're seeing is the Chinese are ramping up their offensive capabilities in a huge way back into the intellectual property sphere. And I think there's a lot of fear right now that they also could end up trying to manipulate our elections. They certainly have no more respect for democracy than the Russians do. And given the trade war right now, it's an open question as to whether or not they may escalate in that domain.
So one of the reasons you wrote the book is to make the point that America has to come up with strategies to counter the cyber warfare that's aimed at us from countries like Russia, China, wherever. And you come up in your chapter on Democracy Shield with two unlikely partners in these hyper-partisan days. That would be Laura Rosenberger and Eli Fry. I wonder if you could tell us who they are and why I say they're bipartisan, and then most importantly, the program.
So Laura and Eli come from opposite sides of the spectrum. I served in the Obama administration with Laura. She's an incredible leader there and has been an incredible leader on the outside now at the German Marshall Fund. And so what she's working on is really transatlantic efforts to combat election interference. And she's got a great partner in Eli, right, who comes from the opposite side of the spectrum, right? I think that the most important thing to understand is that in 2020, nobody should assume that interference will be by just one country or on just one side. And so from that perspective, the need to approach this problem from a bipartisan standpoint couldn't be more important.
Well, and I guess that raises the question that occurred to me as I'm reading your book. What's behind the reluctance as to why we're not doing more? And I've got to say that it seems as though the Republicans in 2016 certainly were the major beneficiaries of this. So when you start looking in Congress for solutions, as you propose we do in your book, at least today, it seems like the toughest thing to do is to get Republicans to understand, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, that what may be to their benefit today could well be to their disadvantage in 2 or 3 or 4 years when all of a sudden the tables are turned and now some country is going after their party instead of a Democratic election. Your thoughts.
So I've been puzzled and troubled in many ways by the reluctance by Congress in particular to invest heavily in securing our elections. Right, we don't have any evidence of actual voting system manipulation in 2016. That is, we don't believe that any votes were actually switched electronically through cyber attacks. But we also don't necessarily know that they weren't, given the state of the election infrastructure in this country, which is 20 years old for the most part, if it's electronic, not patchable, not updatable, and definitely insecure. And so what many of us have called for is a massive investment in securing these systems, in returning to paper ballots, and to creating paper trails. The kind of investment that we made about 20 years ago in the Help America Vote Act, that was a $2.5 billion effort. I think today we put maybe $250 million into efforts to secure election infrastructure. So I think from that perspective, we certainly have not done enough. The reason I really lay it on Congress is that within the Trump administration, at the Department of Homeland Security, the Federal Election Commission, and other federal agencies, there's been a tremendous focus on this problem. It is the number one thing that the Department of Homeland Security's new cybersecurity and infrastructure security agency is focused on. The leadership there, Chris Krebs and Jeanette Manfra, this is their absolute number one priority, and they really are leading a national effort on it. But what they need is a lot more money and a lot bigger effort, and it's certainly not too late. We're over a year out from the election. There's a lot we could do at this point to bolster the security of these systems.
You're listening to Robert Kanacki. He is the author of The Fifth Domain. His co-author is Richard Clark. Let's talk for a moment about the complexity of preparing for the 2020 election, or any election for that matter. You talk about the election ecosystem, and I think you identify seven different parts to it, all of which, of course, our listeners would know from the time you go to vote until the votes are counted. But the fact is that we run our elections at the state and local level, and there's an argument out there that is called security through diversity that suggests, oh, we don't need the federal government involved in this. We're doing fine at the state and local level. Thank you. Could you help us counter the security through diversity argument?
Yeah, I mean, I think that on a basic level, the idea of saying that a homogeneous system where that has all the same vulnerabilities and is going to be targetable, a single system by a single adversary, that could be dangerous. But on the other hand, 50 state systems or even 10 state systems in the states that are, you know, actually in play every election that are just not secured is going to leave us in a far worse state. I think the approach that the Department of Homeland Security and others who've really focused on election security have taken is to say that what we want to do is not rip the system out of state hands, but we want to secure those systems. So they can be 50 different systems. They can be 50 different systems that are all going to be secured in different ways, but they all need to be secured. And that diversity, if there's that investment in security, could actually be a benefit. Now, what Dick and I say is that if we've got, as we've seen, some states that just seem reluctant to have help, whether that's because they truly are concerned with election interference at the federal level with their state responsibility, or because, as some have suggested, they are simply inviting foreign interference in their systems. I think if those states are reluctant to take support and investment, there's a strong argument to be made that the federal government has the power to remove that responsibility for federal elections from state and localities. And I think that's the ultimate trump card here.
How does the Defending Digital Democracy Project fit in here?
What's great about this program, for a long time, cybersecurity has been a secondary or tertiary concern to campaigns. And that has meant that as you're standing up, particularly at the presidential election level, right, a presidential campaign is essentially a Fortune 500 company that's getting stood up and and stood down in 18 months or so at the most. And so cybersecurity has always kind of been an afterthought. What this program is doing is bringing in capabilities to campaigns from leading cybersecurity vendors. And the Federal Election Commission has given permission for cybersecurity vendors to provide these services for free. So it's essentially, you know, an exception around what would be otherwise a donation to the campaigns that companies couldn't make, as long as essentially they're offering the capability regardless of partisan affiliation, right? So the companies that are participating, like Google, are providing that capability, as I understand it, to anybody who asks through this Defending Digital Campaigns program.
One of the strategies that the Russians used, I believe this was after the 2016 election, but they created two bogus events on Facebook. One was against Islam, and one was called United Muslims of America, and it was pro-Islam. And it really played one against the other and enticed them into showing up at the same place and the same time just to create dissension in the community. I think this happened in Texas. And as I said, it happened after the 2016 election. Maybe this is more of a social media question, but I guess I'm just wondering, what is being done to prevent that kind of thing from happening in 2020 or any time beyond that?
Well, the good news and the bad news is that all the major platforms are now looking at this as a problem, recognizing that it's hurting their brand, recognizing that it's hurting democracy, and they've developed very large teams. So, I mean, Facebook now has a small army of people around the world and in the United States that are looking for posts that violate their rules, including their rules about being essentially a fake account, right? On Facebook and on LinkedIn, you have to use your real name. And so, you know, they're trying to detect both through technology and through monitoring by actual live humans, the creation of these fake accounts. The problem that they're confronting is just the scale. So I think Facebook last year probably eliminated on the order of 10 billion fake accounts. That shows you how easy it is to create a fake account and how few you might need to get past these programs in order to be able to sow that kind of dissent and discord. And so it's really in many ways a problem that technology alone can't solve and that will require a much greater level of coordination with these companies and the U.S. government, the U.S. intelligence community and law enforcement community than I think they want to make. A lot of these companies really like to position themselves as global companies, multinational companies, not as U.S. companies, even if they're headquartered in the United States, even if they're listed on the U.S. stock market. And so they can be very wary about cooperating with the U.S. government. They all have an eye, not really to the Russian market, but to the Chinese market is where, you know, they want to get their next billion users. And so from that perspective, we're not necessarily always operating as if the U.S. government is an ally if you're at a tech company. And in my view, that's one of the main problems we have.
There's so much to cover in your book, and I want again to remind our listeners, this is a must-read. It's The Fifth Domain, Defending Our Country, Our Companies, and Ourselves in the Age of Cyber Threats. Rob, I've got time for one more question, and I want to switch gears a little bit and move out of elections and move over to utilities and our power grids. Just recently, the state of California, actually one of its power companies, decided to cut off power in the interest of preventing wildfires, and the reports we're getting back showed just how critical, we all know this, of course, how critical power is to daily life in any home, for example. And then you start wondering, well, they did it voluntarily, but what if that was thrust upon them by cyber warfare? And you point out in the book, I believe, that basically this is self-regulation at this point as far as the utilities and the power grids are concerned. I wonder if you could just share with us why that's a big problem.
Well, I mean, I think from a certain perspective, the lesson you have to learn about the Russians is what they do in Eastern Europe is usually as a staging ground to what they're going to do against us or in Western Europe. And so you follow that pattern, the election interference, the social media, Discord they've sowed. They perfected those techniques in Eastern Europe, and then they brought them to bear in 2016. Well, from that perspective, Russians have now twice taken down portions of the power grid in Ukraine with cyber attacks. You got to ask yourself why the Russians would bother doing that. I mean, they're on the border with Ukraine. They've got a paramilitary organization operating inside Ukraine, right? They want to take down the power outside Kiev. That's something that they can do without having to use any cyber capabilities. And so those attacks really look to us like trial runs, like what they're planning to do here. And so I think it's a significant concern that when geopolitical circumstances are right for them, they're going to use that capability and they're going to target us. We know from the Director of National Intelligence public testimony last January that the Russians have the capability to disrupt our power supply, at least on a temporary basis and at least on a regional basis. And so that's a scary thing to say. We know they are in our networks. The power grid is regulated, albeit minimally in a form of self-regulation. I think it needs to be far, far tighter. And we've got to see a massive influx of investment by the utility sectors in cybersecurity. The last thing I'll say on that is, as bad as I think cybersecurity is in with the electric sector, there seems to be virtually no security within the pipeline sector. Natural gas pipelines are not regulated for cybersecurity. And that is the power supply, that is the fuel stock that we are increasingly dependent on. So even if you could harden generation and distribution of power, of our power system, if the natural gas systems are vulnerable, the lights could go out just as easily.
Well, I said it was the last question, but I do want to read one sentence that we'll use this. We'll call this the public service announcement from Richard Clark and Robert Kanacki. In the last chapter, you give individuals some pointers on how to handle their own computer security. And here's what it says, and I'm reading it because I'm guilty as charged. It says, if your password is password or 123456 or some other brain dead idea, you might as well stand on the corner and just pass out your money to the homeless. You would at least be doing some good in the process. Is there anything else to be said about that, Rob?
Yeah, I mean, let's end on the password note. Get a password manager, LastPass, 1Password. Some of them are free. The ones that cost money provide you more capability. They're not that expensive. And they'll generate a 100 character password that you can possibly remember, and you can use a different one for every website that you log on to. Highly recommend you do that, and then protect that with multi-factor authentication, using your phone, text message, or an app on it to secure it so that you don't just rely on a single password to protect all those other passwords.
Perfect way to end a very good interview based on an outstanding book, The Fifth Domain, Defending Our Country, Our Companies, and Ourselves in the Age of Cyber Threats by Richard A. Clark and Robert K. Kanacki. Rob Kanacki, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.